Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Judy Berry, our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious, was one of the leading environmental activists on the north coast of California from the late 1980s to the mid-1990s, notwithstanding that she was a victim of a car bombing in 1990 and severely injured. Presumably, the bomb was intended to stop her activities as a leader and organizer for Earth First. The bomb that injured her exploded in May 1990 while she was driving in Oakland, California. It took a tremendous toll on her physically and mentally and resulted in a lawsuit that she brought against the FBI and the Oakland, California Police Department. In the weeks before this interview, which was originally broadcast in November 1993, when Radio Curious was called Government Politics and Ideas, Judy Berry had obtained approximately 5,000 pages of FBI documents, which she had gathered as part of her lawsuit. We spoke about this information and about Judy Berry's background, who she is, and what her ideas were. Judy, you've said that the bombing was not personal, but it was political, as if you just happened to be the point person, and not derogatorily, but the pawn in someone else's strategic move that didn't kill you.
Well, I mean, actually, maybe you could take it as a compliment if you wanted to. Somebody wanted to stop my political activities. It was quite clear. I was organizing Redwood Summer, which is a national action to help protect the last of the old-growth redwoods, and we were getting national attention to the issue. People were coming in. We had called for nonviolence protests and called a nonviolence code. This had expanded the coalition of people who were willing to work on it, and meanwhile, I was building coalitions with the loggers, and as this event was happening, loggers, mill workers were coming forward for the first time and also speaking out against the companies. So I think it's pretty clear who would want to stop me and why. And the bombing was preceded by a series of very frightening death threats, which clearly targeted me for my anti-timber activities.
Well, this has resulted in you responding on a much broader national scale, and you're reaching out, riding a wagon of idealism to change things on a broader national scale. Let's talk, if we can, for a minute about the changes that you're seeking to effect.
Well, basically what happened, I think before we talk about the changes, we'll have to get into more what happened. But briefly, I think that both the FBI and private industry, the big timber corporations, collaborated at least in the setup and the cover-up of this bombing. And I think this may sound like an outlandish charge, but when I go through some of the details, I think it's quite clear. And, you know, this follows a long pattern in the case of the FBI, also in the history of timber, also, of being willing to use violence and frame-ups and anything else to exert their will, and of course, you know, this isn't anything resembling democracy or freedom, freedom of speech, any way to be able to organize, and so, of course, what we're trying to do is prevent that from happening in the future. I don't really know if I'm as idealistic as you portray me, though, after what I've been through. I'm pretty cynical about the government.
Well, I think you are idealistic in the effect that you're focusing your life on this issue and you're trying to make some significant changes. So it's those changes that you're reaching for that I'd like you to talk about.
Okay, well, I really need to preface this by a little more information about what we found in these 5,000 pages. And to start off with, when I was bombed, it wasn't just that I was bombed. I was then within hours of the bombing, I was arrested along with Daryl Cherney, who was in the car with me, and we were blamed for the bombing. They said it was our own bomb and that we were knowingly carrying it with the intent to use it somewhere else, I guess, and that it had accidentally exploded in the car. And this theory contradicted all the evidence that they had in front of them. The bomb was under my car seat. It was hidden there. It was clearly designed to kill me, and it nearly did. Yet they persisted in this theory that we bombed ourselves. In fact, they said we were the only suspects. And they just spread this. They trumpeted it all over the United States in the national media, you know, the Earth's first bombers caught with their own bomb. And actually, it was somebody else's bomb. So after 8 weeks, they were still unable to find any evidence against us, and they stopped pursuing us as the, you know, actively pursuing us, although we're still on their suspect list. And I guess they think I should be satisfied with them stopping saying I bombed myself, and I'm certainly not. I'd like to know who bombed me, and I'd like to know about the role that the FBI and the Oakland Police and the timber companies played in it. And I learned quite a bit when I got these 5,000 pages. And what I learned was something that even was more than I had expected, and that was that not only did the FBI and the Oakland Police conduct nothing vaguely resembling a legitimate search for the bomber at any time during this case, but that instead they used this case as an excuse to conduct broad surveillance on environmental activists both in our region and then later nationwide.
Judy, let me interrupt here. You're making some fairly broad statements here, but I want our listeners to be sure that these statements are made based on your review of the FBI documents as opposed to your conjecture.
Okay, well, I'll get into a little of the specifics of each of these things then. The stages in which this bombing case was handling, there were really basically three stages to it. And during the first stage, they simply presumed that we bombed ourselves, and this was the stage that lasted 8 weeks up until the point in mid-July, at which point the district attorney said there was not enough evidence against us to press charges. And what happened was the bomb went off in the car. I've obtained police photos of it. There's a giant hole in the car. It's maybe about 8 feet long and 3 feet wide, and it's centered smack under the driver's seat. The driver's seat is clearly blown right through. The back seat is clearly intact. No honest observer could mistake where this bomb was. And yet the FBI and Oakland Police stated that the bomb was in the back seat, and therefore it was visible, and so we knew we were carrying it, and it was our bomb. And based on that just blatant lie, they began their campaign. And the only investigation, now don't forget I said I'd been getting all these death threats and stuff beforehand, and yet they did, because they said that we were the only suspects, the only investigation they conducted was to raid my house and Daryl's house and the houses of some of our other associates and confiscate 59 different tools and solder and things like that, tape from us, bomb components, and send them off to the FBI lab, presuming with it that when they came back they would match. And when they came back, nothing matched to us. There was different tools, there was different solder, there was different tape. They couldn't find any of this forensic evidence, as they call it, to match the bomb to us. And this put them in quite a dilemma. Also, the things they found out about during this 8 weeks should have pointed the other direction. They found out that it was an anti-personnel bomb. It was wrapped with nails to use as a shrapnel effect. They certainly found out that it was hidden under the car seat. I have photographs of them holding a mock-up of the bomb in the epicenter of the hole. They knew exactly where it was. And they found out that this bomb was triggered by a motion device, that it was triggered by the motion of the car, so it was like a booby trap bomb. And there's no way that you could presume that those things would mean that I was carrying it. Those would mean that this was a bomb intended to kill me. They also found out I had no history of violence, and neither did any of us involved in this case. So that put them in a kind of a problem. And also, there was a lot of support pouring in from across the country. People were writing letters to the FBI complaining about them arresting us and blaming us for this bombing. And people were writing to their congressmen and women, and they were writing to the FBI. There was quite a bit of pressure put onto the FBI to broaden their circle of suspects.
Judy, I want to talk for a minute here about the pressure that you've been putting on the congressman from this district. I know that on this show, for many, many months, I would ask Frank Riggs, who was the former congressman, about what was going on. And I've regularly asked Dan Hamburg, the present congressman, about what was going on. It seems like there's been some results lately. Why do you see a difference? What do you think brought about the change?
It's very clear what brought about the change. The case is the same as it was 3 years ago. But when the Republican Frank Riggs was in office, because he didn't really support this, although because of public pressure he gave a little bit of lip service, The House Judiciary Committee was not about to go out of their way unless my local congressman supported the case. That kind of tends to be the way it is with Congress. When Frank Riggs was defeated and Dan Hamburg was elected, Dan Hamburg, unsolicited by me, had made one of his campaign promises to seek a congressional investigation of the bombing, and he certainly followed through on that. He has arranged for me to meet with the congressional committee and, you know, kind of sponsored me to get access to them. And so with the difference of Dan Hamburg's support, I've been able to get the ear of the committee.
Well, the first broadcast of this program will be November 29th, and I think that's the day that you're meeting with the Congressional Committee. What do you intend to tell them and share with them?
Well, I intend to tell them what I found in these 5,000 pages and, you know, the way in which this case was used to, that what started as a terrible attack on a couple of environmentalists has grown into this sweeping surveillance, kind of like the Green Scare replacing the Red Scare. I'd like to get into a little bit of the details of that, so like you say, people won't think I'm just making this up. Is that okay? So what happened is once they tried to pin this bombing on us, but they could find no evidence to connect it, the next thing they did was, under pressure to broaden the pool of suspects, they did indeed broaden it. They broadened it only to include other environmentalists. They never seriously considered that anyone other than an environmentalist could have bombed me. And so they conducted what I just have to call a local dragnet of the environmental movement, in which they went around our community and they conducted interviews with 44 hostile sources, both from police and from the timber industry. And by timber industry, I don't mean loggers. They contacted timber management in every timber company they could find in the book and invited them to submit lists of who they think are the environmental activists, any leaflets from us, anything that they can find that they think may be able to incriminate us. And they, of course, they made no similar request of the environmentalists. They didn't ask us to submit lists of the timber companies or timber people who were active, but they did this with us. And just tons and tons of names were submitted, and just some speculation, wild speculation. So this is from the Wise Youth Movement. I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but it's an anti-environmental movement funded by the corporations. And some of the Wise Youth people would speculate, and they'd say, well, this is the core group that we think is capable of violence. Well, none of us had any history of violence. No, none of us have committed any violence since. And at the time, we were in the act of standing up to their lethal force and terror with nonviolence. But based just merely on the speculation of people who were our political rivals in a life and death struggle here, they sent in lists to the FBI headquarters. Here's the violent core. And it was just speculation by the timber industry. They similarly polled the police, and maybe even more outrageously, they polled the local newspaper. And the way that they did that was they sent them a letter. There was a letter sent in this bombing case from someone calling himself the Lord's Avenger, claiming credit for the bomb. And they sent all the local newspapers, these small rural papers, a letter saying, well, we want to look at your letters to the editor's files to see if we can find something to match the Lord's Avenger. And only the largest paper was sophisticated enough to say, no, you can't do that. These are confidential sources. How do you think people would feel who write letters if they found out they were being turned over to the FBI? So nine of these small rural papers here invited the FBI in, and they just looked through, and what they'd say in their directives is, we're looking for letters on the redwood timber issue. And they'd go through the letters to the editor file and pull out letters, and in some cases they just were compiling a database and nothing was done with this information. But in some cases, people who did nothing but write a letter became suspect in the bombing for no reason that I could discern from the content of their letters.
Judy, I want to take a moment and tell our listeners that my guest this week is Judy Berry, and we're talking about the bombing that severely injured her in May of 1990, and her investigation of the FBI investigation and her pending meeting with members of Congress. Judy, talking about the Lord's Avenger letter, you're quoted as saying that you're convinced that the person who wrote that letter was really, it was kind of a red herring, and that the bombing was not done by somebody local to Mendocino County. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, it's the Lord's Avenger did was it claimed that that the person who had bombed me was a fundamentalist Christian who was mad at me for my anti-Operation Rescue, my activities here up in Ukiah. And really, I've only ever been involved in one demonstration on the abortion issue. And, you know, what I think this did is the bomb went off in Oakland, and it had a 12-hour timer in addition to the motion device, and there's no way it could have been placed in Mendocino County. But the Lord's Avenger claimed that he placed the bomb in Mendocino County and that the Lord had stayed the clock for 2 days so that I could, you know, get down to Oakland, and then the Lord let the bomb explode. Well,
now, when you say it had a 12-hour timer, that's based on the data you've received from the FBI?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I don't know if any of this is true, but from all data I've seen, it was connected to a watch which had to, like a pocket watch with the minute hand broken off, so it couldn't have been any more than 12 hours, and then they put a piece of solder in it, and when it connects, it completes a circuit. Then also on the same circuit is this motion device where a ball bearing has to drop into a coil of wire, and when both of those devices are completed, the circle is done and the bomb will go off, and that's what all the, you know, I mean, I guess I can't believe anything, but that's what it says. At any rate, by their own...
Well, wait a minute. When you say you can't believe anything, you're going on the assumption that what you have received from the FBI is not necessarily accurate.
Well, there's quite a bit of inaccuracy in it. I'm you know, aware of a lot of inaccuracies. So, I mean, you know, I'm not... presuming that everything in it is true, but I'm not presuming that everything in it is false, but I don't think I can presume everything is true either, because there's quite a few omissions and contradictions and things that I just know are not true from what I know of the case. I want to get into one more part about the surveillance, though, because I think this is a very important part, and I think we're running out of time. And that is that after the FBI finished surveilling the local movement by conducting these sweeping interviews with, you know, just these broad subjects, they still didn't find anything to incriminate us because, in fact, we're nonviolent activists and we didn't bomb ourselves. So they expanded the investigation, and they said that in order to investigate, they were going to have to catalog the phone calls of 14 activists. And these activists are 13 people who hung an Earth Day banner. Talk about a nonviolent action. That's all they did, plus me. And so they took these 14 of us, and they cataloged our phone numbers, our phone calls for 2 months, and they came up with 634 out-of-state phone calls that we had made across the country. And they computerized this list, and they sent it out to every FBI field office across the country and asked them to supply information on these 634 phone numbers that we had called. And the information was the name, the address, place of employment if possible, criminal record, and political associations, indices check they call it, you know, whether the FBI has anything on you. So for no crime other than receiving a phone call from an environmentalist who had engaged in a nonviolent banner hanging, you became a suspect. And the FBI, just in this, you know, just broadest as can be, phone survey, checked out people all over the country. And mostly this just seems to be information gathering, as I've said. But I think that that's just totally outrageous that the FBI can be doing this. And to me, it recalls the Red Scares. There's a presumption of criminality, that anything that any environmental activity is presumed criminal. For example, one of the people called in this phone survey is a woman in Wisconsin, and they note that in addition to the phone number here, she has another phone that she calls the Green Line. Well, so what, FBI? You know, does that mean that she's a criminal? And I think that the FBI doing this kind of blind, sweeping search really violates our rights to privacy, our most fundamental rights in this country to conduct political activity without being subject to this kind of intrusion into our lives by the FBI. I think a lot of people who are on that list would be quite surprised to find themselves on the list, and they have no business being on any FBI list. And that's what is so, to me, that's what's so striking about this case. I could get into a lot of details about you know, the investigation itself and what they didn't investigate and how poorly they looked into the things that they should have. But to me, the most important thing is that they expanded this, and rather than search for the bomber, they searched to compile a list of who were environmental activists and who are our associates. And I think that violates every right in the Constitution, and that's why I'm pursuing it.
Judy, you're in your pursuit. You've brought a lawsuit in the United States District Court in San Francisco. The FBI responded with a motion to have itself dismissed from the lawsuit. They lost. It's now before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. What stage is it in the Ninth Circuit?
It's in limbo. It's been there for quite a while. But, you know, we're also suing the Oakland police and on the basically the same charges. And the Oakland police did not appeal. So the Oakland police's case is going through and we're in discovery. On the FBI's case, we technically don't have discovery because it's being appealed, and yet they still gave us these 5,000 documents. Discovery, for those who aren't used to legal things, is in a lawsuit at a certain point, they allow each side to find out what the other side has so we can look at their documents and we can ask them questions, etc. And that's the stage that we're in right now with the Oakland police. With the FBI, in addition to this thing in the Ninth Circuit Court that you're talking about, some of the charges called tort claims are composed in another lawsuit that's called Barry versus United States of America. I kind of like that name. And that case has not been appealed. So it's all tangled up in a mess. Some things we are in appeal, some things aren't, you know, and we just kind of have these three pieces of the case, and we're trying to pursue whatever works, and we're also trying to pursue the congressional investigation.
Judy, why you? What is it in your background that brought you to be the point person on this issue now?
Well, I've been a political organizer basically my entire adult life. And, you know, I got most of my organizing experience in the labor movement, which is a pretty unusual background for an environmentalist in this country. And I've brought that experience to the organizing here. So I think that part of that is that I have a broader view of things than most of the people, certainly in the environmental movement, that I'm not just a conservationist, that, you know, I've been a social justice and environmental justice. I only recently got into the environmental part of it. So I've been, to me, this is something broader. It's all the same issue. This is the movement, and this is the movement for justice, social justice and environmental justice. And it's been a principal part of my life for my whole life. And I think that the skills that I brought to it and the fact that I was looking at things and still am from a broader view than just the immediate issue, I think that those are the reasons that I would be targeted individually. The Wise Use Movement and the timber industry have quite a virulent campaign against the environmental movement. There have been many other environmentalists subject to various kinds of violence. There was just somebody who had their house burned down in Vermont a week ago. There's been quite a few people who have been threatened and violated because of their environmental activities, and you know, there's been quite a lot of threats overtly from the Wise Use Movement. But also the FBI had a campaign going against Earth First, and their campaign I can only describe as COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO was J. Edgar Hoover's nefarious program to sabotage political groups by, he'd say, misdirect and disrupt, misdirect, and neutralize. And, you know, this was used against the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, and, you know, techniques such as assassinations of political leaders and framings of political leaders are part of this COINTELPRO campaign.
Judy, I think when you make broad, sweeping statements like that, it's important that that our listeners know the basis for them, that it's not just your generalities. Can you give that to us?
Yeah, the COINTELPRO operations were discovered, they were exposed by their victims, just as I'm trying to do here. And there were congressional hearings held in 1975, similar to the hearing that I'm seeking now. And it was held by the House, the Senate Judiciary Committee, headed by Senator Church. And so the statements that I'm making about the COINTELPRO program were all exposed in a congressional hearing, which concluded that COINTELPRO, which stands for Counterintelligence Program, was constituted a vast violation of our rights in this country, and it was ordered to be disbanded. So the FBI stopped using the name COINTELPRO, but I'm charging that they're continuing to use the same tactics in COINTELPRO of attempting, it's basically political sabotage, of attempting to discredit activists as they did with us. Instead of nonviolent organizers, they tried to portray us as violent terrorists to scare people away, to to misdirect our movement to get people not to associate us with us, to be afraid to, or to think that we were terrorists instead of what we really were.
Judy, you're obviously a person of conviction and courage. I know that to be true from having spoken with you many other times. And it's clear in your presentation now that you're very dynamic about what you're saying. I think that it's important for the listeners who can't see you to hear about the tremendous physical toll that this bombing has taken on you personally.
Okay, well, you know, the bomb exploded right under me. And it literally broke my back. My backbone physically turns 90 degrees. It crushed my lower two sections. My coccyx and sacrum were basically pulverized by not only by the bombs but by the springs of the seat, which pierced me. And as a result of this, my backbone is permanently dislocated, and my foot is paralyzed. It's actually amazing I can walk. I wasn't expected to. But I have severe nerve damage, which it leaves me always in pain and sometimes in excruciating pain. So it's very limiting. I can neither stand nor sit nor walk for any decent periods of time, just for a little bit each one. So it's very limiting in that I have physical restrictions, and it's very limiting because the nerve damage, if I overextend or whatever, the nerve damage pains that I get can just lay me flat.
Yet you still live in a remote rural cabin in Northern California, and you're the mother of two young kids.
Yes, I am a single mother. I get some help, though. I have in-home social services, a wonderful California welfare program for disabled people, where somebody comes in and helps me with, splitting firewood and, you know, things that I can't do, which is quite a bit out here. But I live out here because I like to live close to the earth. I feel, you know, that's where I get my strength from, and my strength to go on and to do this and to go out into such an intense struggle. I kind of need the quiet and the groundedness of living in a remote area and living in a forest. So that's why I live where I do.
Judy, I know that one of the things that you do is read a lot, and one of the questions that I always like to ask my guests is, tell us about some of the interesting books that you've read lately.
Well, the book I'm reading right now is called A Taste of Power, I guess. It's by Elaine Brown of the Black Panther Party, and it's a history of the Black Panther Party. And I found it quite fascinating because there was so much, well, you know, the premises of the Black Panther Party were quite different than the movement that we're in right now. But the kind of harassment that they were subject to is very similar. In fact, when I was talking about COINTELPRO before, what I didn't get to is that the man who was in charge of the COINTELPRO program against the Black Panthers in Los Angeles is the same man who's in charge of my case, Richard Held. And so, I've found this book really interesting. I don't read much fiction. I mostly read political theory and history. So that's kind of the kind of reading that I do.
Well, Judy Berry, we'll be talking with you again, I hope, about your experiences in Washington, and I want to thank you very much for being with us here on Government Politics and Ideas.
Okay, well, thank you, Berry.
Judy Berry was a leading environmental activist on the North Coast of California from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s when she passed away. The book that she recommends is A Taste of Power, A Black Woman's Story by Elaine Brown. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.